The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's go. Once again, let me remind everybody that we're reading from the dual edition, the December-January. So some of this stuff is kind of Christmassy, but it really can't help it. Angels in Action, Up in Lights. A community puts on a dazzling display of support for a grieving family. For some, putting up Christmas lights is yet another holiday chore. But in the Masucci household, it was always a big day of celebration. Every year on the day after Thanksgiving, Anthony Masucci, the family patriarch, woke up excited to string lights and decorating the lawn of his home in Bethpage, New York. And why wouldn't he be? It was a family affair. Starting in early November, Anthony and his older sister, Connie Masucci, had a tradition of visiting local stores to check out new decorations and to dream up their vision for that year's extravaganza. Anthony's son, Anthony Jr., and daughter Sarah shared the home, and they pitched in as well. Anthony Jr. helped with the wiring, while Sarah hung ornaments on the tree inside the house, playing White Christmas over and over to keep everyone in the spirit. In 2020, as in every other year, Anthony Sr. strung colorful lights all around the roof until it looked as if the sparkles were dripping onto the porch. On the front lawn, he inflated a large white Frosty the Snowman and a Rudolph with a glowing red nose. The whole place looked like a scene from a pop-up Christmas storybook. Anthony Sr.'s sixter had outdone himself, as if the brightness of the lights could counter some of the darkness of the past year with COVID-19. It was such a rough year that he tried his best to make it extra special, Sarah says. When her 18-month-old son, Robbie, saw the finished display, he ran around the yard pointing and giggling. On Christmas Eve, the whole house twinkled with lights and gifts were piled under the tree. Everyone was looking forward to platters of crispy fried calamari and overly stuffed clams, a typical Italian feast. But most of all, they looked forward to enjoying another Christmas together as a family. Then Connie got a call. Someone she worked with had tested positive for COVID-19. Though Connie didn't have any symptoms, she decided to get tested right away. Her rapid test came back positive. Anthony Sr., Anthony Jr., and Sarah decided they should all get tested too. When the results came back, they all learned that they also had COVID-19. Sadly, everyone agreed their Christmas celebration would have to be canceled. At first, everyone's symptoms seemed manageable, but right after the new year on January 4th, Anthony Sr. started having trouble breathing. Anthony Jr. took him to the hospital where he was admitted. 5 days later, Connie began feeling weak and wouldn't eat. Sarah called an ambulance for her, but Connie died before they got to the hospital. Less than a week later, Anthony Sr. passed away. Sarah says the next weeks were the worst of her life. She felt as if she was in a fog. Grief left her doubled over in pain. On top of that, we were still recovering from COVID-19 ourselves, she says. In addition to helping to plan the funerals for her father and her aunt, Sarah had to figure out the mortgage, transfer the utility bills, and tackle a seemingly endless list of difficult to-dos. And perhaps all of all, she had to try to explain to her young son the concept of death. It was almost too much to take. But when she pulled up to the house at the end of the long day, the twinkling Christmas lights brought her a spark of joy. It made us happy to see them, she says. Making it even more poignant, the lights were one of the last memories Sarah and Anthony Jr. had of their beloved family members when they were still alive and healthy. I couldn't bring myself to put them away, says Sarah. Taking the lights down felt like a final act of closure. She and her brother weren't ready to take, so they kept them up. One day in February, Sarah received an envelope in the mail. It had no return address. I thought it contained my dad's ID card, she said. She had been waiting to get a few of her dad's belongings back from the hospital. Inside the envelope, she found an anonymous typed note. Take your Christmas lights down, it's Valentine's Day, the unsigned letter read. Sarah looked at the paper in shock. Then she got angry. We were already dealing with so much, she says. Sarah could have bottled up the anger, but she decided to write about it instead. I wanted to remind people that we all had a tough year. All have been through so much, and people should be a little more caring toward each other, she says. She logged onto a local Long Island mom's Facebook and shared the letter, adding a note of her own. For anyone in the Bethpage area, if you know of a person who would do something so insensitive like this, please pass along my message. She ended the post with this. Be kind to people, because you never know what they are going through. Others in the group rallied to Sarah's side. Her inbox quickly filled with messages of support. A local news station learned what had happened and ran a segment about it. People from all around the area started sending letters and Facebook messages about how they'd lost relatives too, and how it was especially tough to lose loved ones around the holidays. The prevailing sentiment from friends old and new, keep the Christmas lights up. I know what it feels like to lose someone and not want to put their things away. It's very hard, one man told me when he stopped by with roses. Neighbors sent meals and cards and support. Someone even set up a GoFundMe page to help cover the funeral expenses. I wasn't expecting that much support, Sarah says, but having it helped us get through the rough time, just knowing that people could relate. And then something strange happened, began to happen. Sarah was driving back from work that day when she noticed the Christmas lights and decorations were appearing, or reappearing, on neighbors' houses. In most cases, Sarah knew for a fact that the families inside those houses had already taken down their holiday lights. The mystery had a sweet explanation. Her neighbors had gotten together and decided, collectively, to hang their lights back up and turn them back on in honor of Anthony Sr. and Connor. I couldn't believe that someone would send her this letter, the neighbor Karen McGugger told the Washington Post. Losing her wonderful dad from all the neighbors loved, and her beautiful aunt, who was always smiling, is such a tragedy. We were heartbroken. When McGugger's children heard what had happened to Sarah, they were outraged. They went up to the attic to retrieve their box of Christmas lights, and then they, like dozens of others in their neighborhood and surrounding area, got out the ladder and set about reinstalling their holiday lights and decorations. To see the lights in the block lit up again, Sarah says, it touched my heart. The support didn't stop there. When a man formerly named Frank Pesguzzi, who legally changed his name to Santa Claus, saw Sarah's story on TV, he decided to take his Santa suit out of seasonal retirement. He spends the holidays dressing up in Santa's traditional red and white suit along doing appearances for local organizations, including the New York Yankees. On Valentine's Day, Claus rode down Sarah and Anthony Jr. Street in a car parade he had helped organize, which also features Mrs. Claus and the Grinch. One of the first Claus in line bested Frosty the Snowman, while some 60 others followed in vehicles decked out with flashing Christmas lights. We wanted them to see that the community was behind him, Claus says. Sarah, her brother, and her son stood outside the house drinking hot chocolate and waving to the passing crowd. The icing on the cake, it had snowed the night before, so all the lawns were covered with a dusting of white powder. It was as if all the world were conspiring to make sure Sarah and her family had a proper Christmas. We got a little bit of joy back that night, Sarah says. She never learned the identity of the Scrooge who sent the note. But for the Pekuski family, that one mean-spirited act was far outweighed by the so many more acts of kindness. The shows of support by their neighbors were an important reminder that the good does outweigh the bad, and most people have good hearts, she says. A few weeks after Valentine's Day Christmas parade, Sarah and Anthony decided they were ready to take down the lights. Sarah said it was hard to pack them away, but not as hard as I think it would have been if we didn't experience all that support and love. As for this Christmas, Sarah says, we're not going to make it a sad holiday. We will keep the tradition going. We're definitely going to do something big. And if they make their display bright enough, she believes her dad and aunt might be able to see it from heaven. Angels in Action, the kindness of strangers. As our reader's stories show, the most unexpected gifts are often the ones that keep on giving. I was sleep-deprived as I drove home one night in the pouring rain. I was driving too fast. I fell asleep and rolled my truck 6 times. I remember feeling rain on my face and hearing a helicopter. And I remember the doctor who stitched me up. As I was being discharged from the hospital, a nurse put a gigantic pile of coats in my arms. They were not mine, so where did they come from? Apparently, while I was hanging from the truck in the rain, random people had stopped, walked through the shattered glass and crumpled metal, and laid their coats over me to shield me from the elements. I left the hospital with 10 coats. 10 strangers cared about me, even though I made a terrible mistake. I cleaned the coats and put ads in the paper offering to return them, but no one ever came forward. I stayed at them every day for nearly a year, marveling at the goodness of people. I finally gave them to a local church. I still have a photograph of the truck I totaled, and any time I need a reminder of the kindness inherited in humanity, I look at that picture. Jessica Falconer, Belfast, Maine. Soon after my wife was diagnosed with ALS, she could no longer safely ride her beloved bicycle. But she still wanted to ride, so we decided to get a recumbent exercise bike. Off we went to a local shop as we were discussing the pros and cons of a rather expensive model. The owner came over and asked if we needed help. I asked if he offered some kind of rental or buyback program, explaining that my wife's condition was progressive and that she would be able to use the bike only for a short time. He reached down, tore off the pride tag. "It's yours," he said. Then he called every one of his employees and told them to help us load the bike into our vehicle, follow us to our house, and set up the bike. By now, my wife and I are in tears. They both refused to accept any money, not even to cover the gas. Timothy Grove, Durham, Connecticut. I was in South Carolina, having made the trip in a 20-year-old van with just my dog for company and crying for just about all 1,000 miles of the drive. I had learned only a day or two before that my beloved Billy had been killed. One of his friends had driven to me a store to get oil for the van. As I came out of the store, I was approached by an older woman. She walked up to me and enveloped me in the tightest hug. "I read about your brother in the paper," she said. "I pray for him, and I'm going to pray for you." I don't know who she was or how she knew who I was, but this stranger sensed my grief and cared enough to reach out to me. I think of her often. I remember her face and the kindness in her eyes. Sometimes I wonder she was an angel. Yes, she definitely was. Jody Moen, Sandwich, Massachusetts. It was 2 weeks before Christmas. I was an airman at McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. I was married with a 7-month-old son. We lived in an apartment we could barely afford, so I worked part-time as a short-order cook to make the rent. I walked a mile every day to catch a ride to the base. We really couldn't afford Christmas, but this day we heard a knock on the door. When I answered, no one was there, but a Christmas tree was lying at our doorstep. I never found out who left it for us. We cut up and colored newspaper for decorations. I will never forget that kindness. It really embodied the spirit of Christmas. Thornton Pitcher, Allentown, Pennsylvania. After using all my sick time to care for my fiancé after he underwent surgery, I found myself with a major ear infection and working the Christmas rush at a big box store. One day I rang up a nice woman who said she would pray for my health. The next day was rough. Several customers belittled and berated me. Then I felt someone touch my arm. It was the woman from the day before. She said she was glad to see I was looking better. I thanked her and turned back to the register to finger up a customer. After things calmed down, I realized that she had left an envelope with my name on it. Tucked inside with a copy of the Lord's Prayer was a crisp $100 bill. The card was signed Pat. I never saw her again, but I wish I could tell her that her gift kept our lights on that December and paid for the medication I needed to treat my ear. It's been more than 10 years. But I still think about Pat. Elizabeth Church, South Euclid, Ohio. Angels in Action, As You Wish. A balloon breaks at just the right moment to bring two faraway families together. Alvin Badberg, 66, was deep in the woods in Grand Cane, Louisiana, last December, when something caught his eye. Crinkled and entangled in a fallen tree, it looked like a little litter. But Badberg felt compelled to pick it up. "God just told me," he says. As Badberg approached, he saw that the object was a broken balloon. Attached was a piece of paper decorated with sparkling star stickers. It was a child's Christmas list. "Dear Santa," the handwritten note read, "my name is Luna. I am 4 years old. I live in Liberal, Kansas. This year I have been nice. I would like candy, Spider-Man ball, Frozen doll, puppy, My Little Pony, my love, with love, Luna." Bamberg's heart hammered in his chest. Ever since he was a child, he had dreamed of this very scenario. "Years ago," he says, "classes at school released balloons with notes. I've always wanted to find one." He knew this was his childhood wish coming true, and he knew he was going to make Luna's wish come true, too. He just wasn't sure how. Liberal, Kansas is more than 650 miles from Grand Cane, Louisiana, but Bamberg's wife, Leanne Bamberg, was undeterred by the distance. An avid Facebook user, she had seen other people find all sorts of connections to the site and thought it might help her husband find Luna. On January 2nd, 2021, Alvin posted a photo of the balloon and the Christmas list on his Facebook page, asking for help locating the sender. At first, he wasn't confident the strategy would work, but as he saw the number of people sharing his post creep up into the hundreds, my hope grew into expectations, Alvin says. I knew we were going to find Luna. Meanwhile, Leticia Flores Gonzalez, the mother of 4-year-old Luna and her twin sister, Gianella, had no idea that such an effort was underway. She was in Oklahoma City visiting her parents. It had been a hard year for Flores Gonzalez and her girls. A few months before the pandemic hit, her parents had moved out of Kansas. No other relatives lived nearby. As COVID-19 spread, the family felt lonely, scared, and isolated. On a particularly tough day last December, Flores Gonzalez had come up with the idea of having the girls send letters to Santa by balloon. She told them that Santa would grab the balloons while he flew through the air on his sled. The twins were excited. Flores Gonzalez helped them compose their letters, writing down all the things they dreamed Santa might bring them, and put the notes in the festive red balloons. She dressed the girls in identical pink sweatshirts, it was a chilly windy morning, and put floppy bows in their hair, then took them outside to release their wishes to the universe. "Bye, balloons," the girls called, waving, and the balloons floated away, sailing above the trees and into the sky. The family enjoyed a modest Christmas together, and then the calendar turned to a new year. One day in early January, Flores Gonzalez noticed that a friend had been calling her all morning. When Flores Gonzalez finally called her back, the friend blurted out, "Someone found Luna's balloon." "My jaw dropped," Flores Gonzalez says. At her friend's urging, she logged onto Facebook and saw Alvin's post. Then she saw that people from all over were asking if they, too, could be part of fulfilling the wish list. Flores Gonzalez was touched, but she hesitated before reaching out to Alvin. She hadn't really expected anyone to find the balloons, let alone offer to buy gifts for her daughters. But she was curious about this man who had tried so hard to find her family, so she gave him a call. When Albert told her how much it would mean to him to grant the girl's wishes, she agreed to let him send some gifts. "Somebody found one of your balloons," Flores Gonzalez told the twins. "Santa dropped it by accident. One of his elves found it." Back in Louisiana, Alvin got busy collecting toys from his newfound Facebook community. He collected 5 boxes worth of gifts for the girls, sending them off with a note signed Alvin the Elf. Still, there was one wish on the list that couldn't go in the box, a puppy. Alvin had hoped to get every last item on that list, and so, with Florin Gonzalez's blessing, he started searching for the perfect pooch. He found it in a dachshund puppy, which he kept at his home until it was time for Alvin the Elf to make a house call. In April, Alvin and Leanne headed to Oklahoma City. That morning, just as the chilly wind is the day Luna and Gianelle long goodbye to their balloons, Alvin got out of the car in front of the girls' grandparents' house. He let the puppy run to the twins, who squealed with delight when they learned it was theirs. "Is this what you wanted for Christmas, girls?" Flores Gonzalez asked. "Yes," they said as they hugged their new pet. Later, both families sat down together to share homemade tacos. They all agreed. It felt as though they had known each other forever. "We see him as part of our family now," Flores Gonzalez says of Alvin. We keep in touch almost daily. Now, after receiving so much generosity, Flores Gonzalez and her girls intend to pay it forward this year. When they travel to Mexico at Christmas time, they will take toys, clothing, and shoes to give to children there. After all, Alvin went more than the extra mile. He could have just thrown that balloon in the trash, but he wanted to find Luna, Flores Gonzalez says. Alvin feels his chance encounter with that red balloon showed him his calling. He began to attend a Santa Claus training school with the goal of playing jolly old Saint Nick at toy drives and homeless shelters. "God hears our prayers," he says. "When you ask for something, it may not happen immediately. I've wanted this since I was a teenager." Did you know you're breathing all wrong? An easy tweak to this most basic of bodily functions can improve your health, sleep, and general well-being. I didn't know that. Did you know that? Say I'm lying on the examination chair in the Stanford Department of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery Center as Jaya A. Nayak, MD, a nasal and sinus surgeon, gingerly coaches an endoscope camera through the right nasal cavity. He's gone so deep into my head that it's come out the other side into my throat. I'm wearing a pair of video goggles that are streaming a live feed of the journey through the rolling dunes, swampy marshes, and stalactites inside my severely damaged sinuses. I'm trying not to cough or choke or gag as that endoscope squirms a little farther down. "Say," Dr. Nayak repeats. I watch as the soft tissue around my larynx, pink and fleshy, coated in slime, opens and closes like a stop-motion Georgia O'Keeffe flower. This isn't a pleasure cruise. 25 sextillion molecules, that's 250 with 20 zeros after it, take this same voyage 18 times a minute, 25,000 times a day. I've come here to see, feel, and learn where all this air is supposed to enter our bodies. And I've come to say goodbye to my nose for the next 10 days, in a quest to learn how to breathe better by first breathing all wrong. For the past century, the prevailing belief in Western medicine was that the nose is more or less an ancillary organ. We should breathe out of it if we can, and thinking went, but if not, no problem. That's what the mouth is for. Dr. Nye finds this absurd. He is chief of rhinology research at Stanford and heads an internationally renowned laboratory focused entirely on understanding the power of the nose. That's why he's so interested to see what happens in a body that functions without one. Starting today, I'll spend the next quarter of a million breaths with silicone plugs blocking my nostrils and surgical tape over the plugs to stop even the faintest amount of air from entering my existing or exiting my nose. I'll breathe only through my mouth. A heinous experiment that will be exhausting and miserable, but has a clear point. 40% of today's population suffers from chronic nasal obstruction, and around half of us are habitual mouth breathers. The causes are many. Dry air to stress, inflammation to allergies, pollution to pharmaceuticals. But much of the blame, I'll soon learn, can be placed on the ever-shrinking real estate in the front of the human skull. When mouths don't grow wide enough, the roof of the mouth tends to rise up instead of out, forming what's called a V-shape or high arc palate. The upward growth impedes the development of the nasal cavity, shrinking it and disrupting the delicate structures in the nose. The reduced nasal space leads to obstruction and inhibits airflow. Overall, humans have the sad distinction of being the most plugged-up species on Earth. Now, that's funny. Nearly everyone I know suffered from one problem or another: stuffy nose, wheezing, asthma, allergies, snoring, and the rest. I'd always thought those problems were a normal part of being human, but I came to learn that they didn't randomly develop. Our ancient ancestors very likely never suffered from widespread snoring, sleep apnea, sinusitis, or many other chronic respiratory problems that affect the modern population. They did not because they could not. Their mouths were far too large and their airways too wide for anything to block them. They breathed easily. As humans evolved, the growing brain needed space to stretch out, and it took it from our faces, sinuses, mouths, and airways. Over time, the face shortened, the mouth shrank, leaving behind a smaller vertical position nose that was less efficient at filtering, exposing us to more airborne pathogens and bacteria. The smaller sinuses and mouth also reduced the space in our throats. Strangely, sadly, the same adaptations that would allow our ancestors to outwit, outmaneuver, and outlive other animals, a mastery of fire and processing food, an enormous brain, and the ability to communicate in a vast range of sounds, would obstruct our mouths and make it much harder for us to breathe. This recessed growth would much later make us prone to choke on our own bodies when we sleep, to snore. It's evening on the second day of the mouth breathing experiment, and I'm in bed with silicone plugs jammed inside my nasal cavities, covered with tape. I've got a pulse oximeter device about the size of a matchbook strapped to my wrist and fingers. Every few seconds, it records my heart rate and blood oxygen levels. Using this to assess how often or how severely my too deep tongue gets lodged in my too small mouth and causes me to hold my breath, a condition more commonly known as sleep apnea. To gauge the severity of my snoring and sleep apnea, I've downloaded an app that records a constant stream of audio through the night that provides a minute-to-minute graph of my breathing health every morning. A security camera above the bed monitors every movement. Last night, in my first full run of self-inflicted nasal-obstructing sleeping, my snoring increased by 1,300% to 75 minutes through the night. I bet he's not married. I also suffered a fourfold increase in sleep apnea events. All this in just 24 hours. When seasonal allergies hit, incidents of sleep apnea and breathing difficulties shoot up. The nose gets stuffed, we start mouth breathing, and the airways collapse. It's simple physics, Patrick McCowan, one of the world's leading experts on nasal breathing. Sleeping with an open mouth exacerbates these problems. Whenever we put our heads on a pillow, gravity pulls the soft tissues in the throat and tongue down, closing off the airway even more. An estimated 60% of the population sleeps with an open mouth. After a while, our airway gets conditioned to this open position. Snoring and sleep apnea become the new normal. But contrary to what most of us might think, no amount of snoring is normal. And sleep apnea carries its own risk of serious health effects, terribly damaging the body and mind, increasing the risk of maladies including attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, diabetes, high blood pressure, cancer, and so on. A report from the Mayo Clinic found that chronic insomnia, long assumed to be a psychological problem, is often a breathing problem. Another problem with mouth breathing is that we deny our nostrils the job of filtering, heating, and conditioning the air we breathe. It turns out that the nostrils of every living person pulse to their own rhythm, opening and closing like a flower in response to our moods, mental states, and perhaps even the sun and the moon. In a single breath, more molecules will pass through your nostrils than all the grains of sand on all the world's beaches, trillions and trillions of these. These little bits come from a few feet or several yards away, and they make their way towards you. They'll twist and spool like stars in a Van Gogh, traveling into us a clip of about 5 miles per hour. What direct this rambling path are turbinites, 6 maze-like bones, 3 on each side, that begin at the opening of your nostrils and end up just below your eyes. The lower turbinates are covered in pulsing erectile tissue, itself covered in mucous membrane, a nappy sheen of cells that moistens and warms breath to your body temperature while simultaneously filling out particles and pollutants that can cause infections and irritation if they got into the lungs. Mucus is the body's first line of defense. If it's constantly on the move, sweeping along at a rate of about 0.5 inch every minute, more than 60 feet per day. Like a giant conveyor belt, it collects inhaled debris in the nose, then moves all the junk down the throat and into the stomach, where it's sterilized by stomach acid, delivered to the intestines and sent out of your body. This conveyor belt is pushed by millions of tiny hair-like structures called cilia that sway with each inhale and exhale at a fast clip of up to 16 beats per second. These coordinated movements keep mucus moving ever deeper into us. The cilia dip is so strong that it can even push against the force of gravity. No matter what position the nose and head is in, whether upside down or right side up, the cilia will keep pushing inward and down, working together all these systems in the nostrils and nose clean. Slow, treat, and pressurize air so lungs can extract more oxygen with each breath. This is yet another reason why nasal breathing is far more healthy and efficient than breathing through the mouth. As Dionyak explained when I first met him, the nose is the silent warrior, the gatekeeper of our bodies, pharmacist of our minds, and weather vane to our emotions. On that last terrible night of experiment, I'm sitting in bed again, unable to sleep. It's been 10 days since I first plugged my nose in the Stanford experiment, and I'm feeling the real damaging effects of mouth breathing has on the mind and body. It's awful. I feel anxious, stressed, fatigued, and dazed. But the impact isn't just psychological. It's physical, too. My blood pressure has continued to rise throughout the past week. I'm now deep into stage 2 hypertension, a condition shared by a third of the U.S. population, which can cause heart attack, stroke, and other serious problems. Meanwhile, my heart rate variability, a measure of the nervous system balance, plummeted, my pulse increased, my body temperature decreased, and snoring and sleep apnea have continued unabated. Scientific studies have clearly shown that how we breathe can have a powerful impact on all of this. Our circulation, heart function, digestion, stress, and even cognitive disorders, such as Alzheimer's and panic. I'd read dozens of those studies, but it's something else to feel those damaging effects personally. As I toss and turn, my frazzled mind keeps going back to all those kids who've been told that chronic allergies and congestion were part of a childhood, and the adults who convinced themselves that snoring and choking every night was a natural part of growing old. There's nothing natural about any of it. The next morning, back at Stanford, Dr. Nyack nudges an endoscope up my right nozzle once again. The smooth desert dunes I journeyed through 10 days ago look as if they've been hit by a hurricane. I'll skip the details. Let's just say my nasal cavity is a mess. "Now your favorite part," says Dr. Nyack, chuckling. Before I sneeze or consider running away, he grabs a small wire brush and pushes it a few inches into my head. "It's pretty soupy in there," he says. He repeats with the left nozzle and places the gunk-covered RNA brushes in a test tube, then scoots me out of the way. For the past week and a half, I'd been waiting for this moment, anticipated removing those plugs and tape and cotton to be a celebratory scene involving high fives and navel sighs of relief. I could breathe like a healthy human again. In reality, it's not until I get home that evening and rinse my sinuses several times that I can take a full breath through my nose. I grab a coat and walk barefoot in the backyard. There are wispy plumes of cirrus clouds moving across the night as big as spaceships. Above them, a few stubborn stars punch the mist and cluster around a waxing moon. I exhale stale air from my chest and take in a breath through my nose. I smell the sour old sock stink of mud, the black label chapstick of the damp doormat, a Lysol whiff of the lemon tree, and the anise tinge of drying leaves. Each of these scents, this material in the world, explodes in my head in a technicolor burst. The scents are so sparkling and alarming that I can almost see them, a billion colored dots in a Seurat painting. Standing here alone, nostrils flaring, it occurs to me that breathing is so much more than just getting air into our bodies. It's the most intimate connection to our surroundings. Everything you or I or any other breathing thing has ever put in the mouth or in its nose or soaked in through its skin is hand-me-down space dust that's been around for 13.8 billion years. This wayward matter has been split apart by sunlight, spread through the universe, and come back together again. To breathe is to absorb ourselves in what surrounds us, to take in little bits of life, understand them, and give pieces of ourself back out. Respiration is, as its core, reciprocation. Respiration, I'm hoping, can also lead to restoration. Starting today, I will attempt to heal whatever damage has been done over the past 10 days of mouth breathing and try to ensure health in the future. The first step is to breathe through my nose all day and all night. How to breathe better? Everyone can benefit from this simple breathing technique. Breathe in for about 5 to 6 seconds, then exhale for the same count. Breathe through your nose if you can. That's it. Simple, yet subtle. Now we'll switch over to Consumer Reports, and we'll continue with the thing we had where they're talking about the best and the worst and how the trouble with spices, the different problems they have with heavy metals and spices. A 2010 study linked a case of lead poisoning in a 12-month-old Massachusetts boy, in part to turmeric used by the family. 5 similar cases were later discovered in Arizona, California, Colorado, Connecticut, and New York, and more than a dozen turmeric products have been recalled since 2011. CR's tests, however, demonstrate that it is possible for spice companies to limit heavy metals in their products. About 2/3 of the spices we tested did not have concerning levels of heavy metals, Ackerlin says, so we know spices have to be worrisome amounts of lead or arsenic or any other heavy metal. The Food and Drug Administration is responsible for the safety of spices. The agency has a set of limits on heavy metals in food, except in a few cases, such as arsenic in infant rice cereal, and lead in candy. But spice companies are required to periodically conduct a food safety analysis, which includes controlling chemical hazards such as heavy metals, says Brian Ronholm, Director of Food Policy at Consumer Reports. Heavy metal content testing is part of a wider risk assessment process the FDA may take. The FDA may undertake if it determines the sample collection analysis is warranted for a specific shipment, an agency spokesman said. Importantly, the FDA can also test spices shipped to the U.S. and block products if it identifies a health risk. That's important because most spices sold in the U.S. are grown abroad, in countries such as China, India, and in Vietnam. And some research suggests the oversight of food production there is sometimes less rigorous. However, while you might want to know where spices you always are grown, that's not always easy to determine. CR's food safety experts found many labeled as packed in the USA, but no other information was listed. Other products listed in multiple countries would suggest the final product was a mixture of spices from more than one source. And I'm going to editorialize for a moment here. I worked in New Jersey for a number of years, and at the time I was selling a product, a welding product and things, and I went to this spice company where they would mix the spices from overseas, and they would have to weld the different pipes and stuff, and that's how I got into this thing. And let me tell you something, that was the best-smelling place I've ever been in my life. Gosh, it smelled good. But anyway, so that's very common. It's not unusual for them to mix these spices locally. Currently, about 2 dozen spice companies from 11 countries are subject to import alerts for lead contamination, which signals to regulators that they contain those products. But that represents a fraction of the herbs and spices shipped to the U.S. In addition, the limited testing FDA has done on spices has been focused on harmful bacteria, such as salmonella, not heavy metals, Rollum says. Self-policing. The lack of regulation leaves much of the monitoring of heavy metal levels to the spice company. CR contacted all the ones with products in our test to see how they limited heavy metals. Of the companies that replied to our questions, Al-Wadi Al-Kahdar, Costco, Boulder's Fiesta, Gebhardt, Lighthouse, McCormick, Roland Foods, Spice Islands, Target, and Whole Foods, a few said they require their suppliers to have a program for control and testing for heavy metals. But only 3, Al-Wadi Al-Akhdar, Boulder's Fiesta, and McCormick, specifically said they test products in their manufacturing plants for heavy metals. Costco, Lighthouse, and McCormick said their goal is to have heavy metals as close to zero as possible, but no company provided the thresholds they consider acceptable. For years, California has required the products exceed limits for substances known to cause cancer or reproductive harm, including heavy metals, carry a warning label. But New York is currently the only state to have enacted limits for heavy metals in spices. It set them after issuing recalls of more than 100 spices because of heavy metal contamination. Since 2016, says Jola Subaleski, a spokesperson for the New York State Department of Agriculture and Markets, once enforcement begins, the state can force a recall of products with elevated levels of heavy metals. Season safety. While the risk of heavy metals in spices and herbs is real, limiting your risk doesn't mean dooming yourself to a life of bland food or giving up old family favorites. Follow these tips. Choose products with the lowest levels of heavy metals. CR's test found at least one product that fit in our no-concern category for every spice and herb we tested except oregano and thyme. Focus on spices and herbs that are lower in heavy metals. These were black pepper, coriander, curry powder, garlic powder, saffron, sesame seeds, and white pepper. That doesn't mean that every brand of these herbs and spices is low in heavy metals, because we didn't test them all. But it's easy to find low-risk versions of all those spices. Don't assume some brands are safer than others. CR's test could not determine whether one brand was consistently better or worse than any other, and organic products did not have consistently lower levels than conventionally grown ones. Well, that might surprise some. CR's Ron Holm says the USDA's organic standards don't include heavy metal testing. Grow and dry your own. That might be a particularly good idea if you use a lot of basil, oregano, and thyme. In all our tests, all or almost all the brands tested were high in heavy metals. Think twice about bringing back spices from abroad. Heavy metal contact can be much higher on those spices, according to other research. U.S. companies may buy the highest quality spices to import, Ronholm says, which could leave lower quality spices to be sold in the country of origin. Consider your total potential exposure to heavy metals. This is especially important if you have kids at home. Our tests are a reminder you should take steps to limit your potential exposure from heavy metals from all sources. That means not only choosing seasonings that pose little risk when you can, but also, for example, testing your water for lead and arsenic, and if levels are high, installing water filter. If you have young children at home, see CR's advice on choosing juices and infant cereals that are low in heavy metals at cr.org/fruitjuice1221 and cr.org/babyfood1221. Your do-it-yourself guides to herbs and spices. When Karen Washington, a food activist and farmer, recalls holiday meals with her family, one herb stands out, thyme. What's a Thanksgiving turkey without thyme, she says. And at other times of the year, it's the most common herb used in her kitchen, she says. But if you use a lot of thyme, or basil or oregano, and are concerned that most or all brands CR tested had high levels of heavy metals, don't worry, you don't have to skip them. Instead, Washington says, grow your own in your yard, on your patio or porch, or in a sunny spot inside. No matter how small or how big, the fact that you can control even part of your food system by growing, nourishing, and harvesting something is a powerful act. The co-founder of nonprofit organization Black Urban Growers, Miss Washington, and co-owner Rise and Root Farm in Chester, New York. And if you want to dry those herbs for future use, she suggests you this. Put them in a dry paper bag for several weeks. For more on how to grow and dry herbs and a story about the store, read on, which we shall. Grow your own. Here's what you need to do in addition to buying seeds or starter plants. Pick a warm, sunny spot. An indoor windowsill or a small outdoor space will do, as long as the location you choose gets at least 6 hours of sunlight each day. Too dark inside? Try a grow kit. These often come with lights, but some are hydroponic, meaning they require only water, not soil. If you can, keep the temperature at about 60 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and you can grow indoor all year. Get pots with good drainage. Standing water is a no-no for herbs. It promotes root rot. To encourage drainage, put a few rocks at the bottom of a pot that also has a hole in it and raise it slightly on a saucer. Pro tip, each type of herb should have its own pot. Don't crowd the plants, though, because needs may differ. Use good soil. If you want herbs that are free of heavy metals, you'll need soil free of them, too. If you're buying potting soil, look for a product that carries the OMRI listed seal, which means it is assessed for heavy metals by the Organic Materials Review Institute. If you're using your own dirt, consider testing it. You can buy a kit at many hardware stores or online, and though it may screen only for lead, or contact your local agriculture cooperative extension office for advice on testing. Check your water. If you're not sure whether your water is free of heavy metals, you can test that too. You can also consider using water that comes through a filter that has been certified to remove heavy metals. Dry your own. For our herb drying test, a CR staffer tried an air fryer, a toaster oven, and a multi-cooker in her home kitchen. All are from CR's list of recommended products and all have a dehydrate function. We used fresh basil, first pinching off the leaves and the stem, then rinsing and drying. In each case, we selected the dehydrate function on the device, and once warmed, placed a single layer of basil in it. Here's what you need to know about each. Air fryer. Preheat to 135 degrees. Place on the crisper tray and dry for 30 minutes. This was the fastest in our test, but the fryer has a limited basket capacity, so it's best for small quantities. The model tested was the Gourmet GAF-686 at $70. Toaster oven. Preheat to 125 degrees. Place on a dehydration rack. Dry for 4 hours. This was the slowest of the methods we tried, but you can do a lot at once, so it is ideal for drying large amounts. The model tested was the Breville BOV908BSS, $400. That's a lot of money. Multi-cooker. Preheat to 125 degrees. Placed on multi-cooker basket. Try for 3 hours and 30 minutes. This device had limited space. To increase capacity, considering buy a multi-layer stainless steel dehydrator rack that fits in the device. They used the Instant Pot Duo Crisp for $120. Now, how to store your spices? CR Food Experts offer tips on keeping your spices fresh. Keep spices in small, airtight containers. Large containers or bulky bags invite air and moisture, which can affect the flavor or cause the spice to cake up, says CR nutritionist Amy Keating. Store them in cool, dark, dry spaces. Sunlight, heat, and moisture can diminish the flavor and aroma, says Sana Moshied, PhD, Manager of Food Safety Research and Testing at CR. So don't keep spices in a cabinet above the stove or near the dishwasher. And if you keep spices on your countertop, only do that if you use that dried spice often, she says. Don't refrigerate or freeze spices. Doing so won't extend their shelf life. In fact, chilling or freezing may make them spoil faster. Don't sprinkle a spice directly into a hot dish. The steam can carry moisture into the container, says Kitty says. Transfer spice to a spoon or dish, then add it to the pot. Give your spices the sniff test. Dried herbs and spices don't go bad in the sense that they become unsafe to eat, but the aroma and flavor fade over time. In general, that means 2 to 4 years for whole spices such as allspice, clove, and nutmeg, and 2 to 3 years for ground ones like curry and ginger, according to the Department of Agriculture. But in some cases, they can degrade faster. If you can't smell the spice, regardless of how long you've had it, it's lacking in freshness, Keating says, so it's probably time to toss it. And here's a subject that's fairly dear to my heart. Well, actually, it's dear to my head. Big news about hearing aids. With so many options for devices that offer help, how can you decide which one is right for you? Here, expert advice is on what's available now and what is expected when over-the-counter hearing aids debut, possibly as soon as 2022, which they will do this year. Hearing aids are becoming cheaper, more accessible, and more technologically sophisticated. But with many new options on the market, the process of choosing a pair has also become more complicated. In the past, consumers usually brought hearing aids from an audiologist or other medical professional, and they cost an average of $2,363 per ear. Then 4 years ago, Congress passed a landmark law allowing hearing aids to be sold over-the-counter to adults with mild to moderate hearing loss. The law was intended to make the devices more affordable and easier to buy. But because of delays at the Food and Drug Administration caused by the complexity of the task and the pandemic, there are still no official rules about OTC devices. This means that product meeting the government definition of an OTC hearing aid aren't actually available today. Now, remember, this is printed about 2 months ago. And since then, I believe the technology has been approved. The market for easy-to-buy hearing improvement products has exploded anyway, resulting in a confusing array of options sold with claims that they can boost your hearing without the need to see a doctor or an audiologist. These devices are often cheaper, some far cheaper, than conventional hearing aids. But without federal standards or professional guidance, it can be difficult to know which products will really help. Broadly speaking, these devices break into three categories. Personal sound amplification products, PSAPs, which you might see on store shelves, provide simple amplification, but the FDA forbids them from being marketed as hearing aids or as a treatment for hearing loss. Legally speaking, they're not medical devices at all. Apple AirPods Pro and Max, for example, can be configured to function similar to PSAPs. There's also a single device made by Bose that's in a separate FDA-approved category for self-fitting hearing aids. A third type of product is the one many experts refer to as direct-to-consumer DTC hearing aids, sold by upstart companies like Eargo and Lively, as well as older ones like Lloyd. DTT's devices don't require a visit to an audiologist or a hearing aid dispenser, and consumers can get them online or by mail order. This is possible in part because the FDA has long allowed consumers to waive medical evaluation before buying a hearing aid, and federal laws don't prohibit the online or mail order sale of hearing aids. Some state laws do, but legal disputes have left their validity and enforceability in question. In recent years, the number of DTC aids on the market has ballooned. The FDA considers most hearing aids to be low-risk devices, so it doesn't require companies to demonstrate that they're safe and effective before selling them. And DTC and traditional hearing aids are often essentially the same, sometimes even produced by the same manufacturer. The main difference is how you buy them. While buying in person allows providers to spot test products and offer some quality control, they may carry only a limited selection of brands and models. Many consumers are understandably tempted to try the DTC route instead because those aids often cost less and are easy to get. The issue right now from a consumer point of view is that it's so confusing, says Frank Lynn, MD, PhD, director of the Cochlear Implant for Hearing and Public Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School for Public Health. You don't know which ones are good. You don't know which ones are bad. Should you try DTC hearing aids? Experts we asked had a range of answers. What's clear is it's better to get hearing help sooner rather than later. The risk of non-treatment are greater than the risk of less than perfect treatment, says Kim Kavett, audiologist, a hearing aid healthcare consultant. Untreated hearing loss linked to increased risk of depression, isolation, and even dementia. In the past decade, experts have come to realize that requiring people to see a doctor or an audiologist may provide some quality control, but also adds cost and complication and limits consumers' options. Those obstacles, along with the persistent stigma of wearing hearing aids, may explain why so many people who need devices don't get them. Kavett's advice is that while there are no guarantees about DTC hearing aids, any hearing help is better than none at all. Some experts told us they advise consumers to stick with purchasing hearing aids through a licensed provider, at least until FDA-approved OTC aids are available. The Federal Trade Commission also advises consumers to avoid DTC hearing aids because people might not get their professional guidance that can help steer them to the right aid for their particular needs. It's likely the final FDA rules for OTC devices won't be released until sometime in 2022, and then there will be an additional lag while manufacturers make sure their products are in compliance. With all that in mind, if you do opt to go the DTC route, here are tips to help you weigh your options. Get your hearing tested. Several of the experts we spoke with recommended getting a hearing test before embarking on a search for DTC hearing aids. Start with your primary care doctor, because some insurance plans, including Medicare, will cover a test only if you have a referral. Some DTC companies let you upload an audiogram from an audiologist, or they offer remote hearing assessments that can help you determine if their products might work for you. Without a hearing test, many people underestimate the amount of hearing loss they have, says Thomas Powers, PhD, a consultant to the hearing aid industry. You may not get something that's appropriate for you if you don't know exactly what you need, he says. Still, having to get a hearing test can be a significant barrier for some, says Carrie Neiman, MD, an assistant professor in the Department of Otolaryngology. Sorry about that. Head and neck surgery at the Johns Hopkins University of Medicine. If you don't have ear pain or other concerns, and the trouble you're having with hearing is relatively mild, she says that getting a test may not be an absolute necessity. You may also want to be checked for possible medical problems. The FDA requires hearing aids to be sold with a notice to consumers that a medical evaluation is advisable to rule out reversible or medically serious causes of hearing loss. The agency requires such an evaluation for people younger than 18, although adults can waive it. If you're not sure whether you should seek a doctor's help, consider start with a free online consumer ear disease risk assessment at sites northwestern.edu/CEDRA, C-E-D-R-A, developed by Northwestern University. It's still a testing phase, but it may help flag ear problems that require a doctor's visit. Check out the return policy before you buy. Make sure you can return whatever you buy. Several companies offer a full refund for under 30 or 60 days after you receive the hearing aids. And some, such as MD Hearing and Lexi, recommend you try them out for a minimum of 21 days. That's because it can take some time to adjust to a new pair. Whatever company you choose, make sure you'll be able to try hearing aids for at least a few weeks. Don't be fooled by FDA registered. FDA registered and FDA cleared don't mean much. Companies sometimes use tricky language to imply that their devices have been carefully reviewed in some way by the agency, when that's usually not the case. Consider customer service. You may prefer to buy from a company that offers more support, such as consultations with an audiologist over the phone or online. Ergo and Livy, for example, offer consults with licensed hearing professionals who can also make remote adjustments to your hearing aids. But keep in mind that the more services a company offers, the more expensive the product may be. This is a reason the cost for traditional hearing aids is high. The evaluation, customization, and service are a significant part of the price. Pay close attention to the features. Rechargeable batteries rather than tiny, hard-to-handle replacement batteries can be a plus for many people. Another helpful feature is a telecoil or T-coil, which allows you to use your hearing aids to tap directly into assistive listening systems at large events, places of worship, theaters, and elsewhere. And Bluetooth can be used for people who are regular smartphone users. It can allow you to use your hearing aids to talk on the phone or stream music, Neiman says. If you buy a DTC hearing aid and it doesn't work out for you, don't give up, urges Barbara Kelly, Executive Director of Hearing Loss Association of America. It might just not be a good device. Return it and try again. Consider consulting an audiologist. There's almost surely something out there that can help. A Guide to Hearing Helpers. The distinctions between types can be hard to tease out, but the devices are regulated differently. Traditionally, direct-to-consumer aids must be sold with basic information required by the Food and Drug Administration. Traditional hearing aids are sold only by in-person provider. Some personal sound amplification products look like hearing aids, but can't be marketed as such. Self-fitting hearing aids are a new category of their own. Here's how to make sense of it all. Traditional hearing aids, brands and prices. Kirkland Signature, Oticon, Phonak, I have Phonak, Resound, Starkey, $1,400 to $6,000 a pair. Where to buy an audiologist, ENT, hearing aid dispenser such as Costco or licensed hearing professionals. What they are. Regulated by the Food and Drug Administration since 1977, these are wearable devices meant to compensate for hearing loss. They come in many styles such as behind the ear and in the ear canal. You buy them through audiologists or other licensed hearing aid dispenser who would evaluate you and adjust the hearing aids to fit your needs. Most devices are made by just a handful of companies that dominate the market, which can eliminate a consumer's choice. What they are for, people with mild, moderate, or severe hearing loss. Personal sound amplification products, PSAPs. Bell & Howell, Britsco, Intomotic, Soundtastic, and Soundboard are the manufacturers. They're anywhere from $30 to $700 a pair. You can buy them online or on store shelves. They seem similar to hearing aids. They even look alike. But officially, they're intended to amplify sound only for people without hearing loss in situations where amplification might be helpful, such as listening to lectures from far away or watching TV shows on low volume. Some PSAPs operate similar to hearing aids, and published research suggests that certain models can be helpful to some people with mild to moderate hearing loss. What they are for may be an option for some people with mild to moderate hearing loss, though the FDA doesn't permit PSAP sellers to market to this group. Direct-to-consumer DTC hearing aids. Now, these look just like regular hearing aids. Audion Hearing, Ergo, Hearing Help, Express, Lexi, Lively, Lloyd, MD Hearing Aid. They cost $150 to $3,000 a pair. You can buy them online, via mail, store shelves in certain states. This is a term used to describe hearing aids sold directly to consumers, generally online and by mail order. Some companies offer customization and significant online support from hearing healthcare professionals. Other sellers offer just one or two hearing aid products that can't be customized. The Federal Trade Commission advises consumers to avoid DTC hearing aids that aren't sold by a licensed dispenser. It also cautions against products with only two settings, loud and louder, because they might actually harm your hearing. And what are they for? People with mild to moderate hearing losses. And then there are self-fitting hearing aids. They're made by Bose. They cost $850 a pair. And you buy them online via Bose. There's only one product in this category, the Bose Sound Control Hearing Aids. Self-fitting refers not to how the hearing aids physically fit into your ears, but how the device's output is adjusted. People with this device download Bose's corresponding app and use it to adjust the settings based on how it sounds. This is in place of the adjustments that audiologists would make with traditional hearing aids. Users continue to make adjustments in real time. And this is for people with moderate and mild to hearing loss. Coming soon, FDA-approved over-the-counter hearing aids. These devices aren't on the market yet, but will be available without requiring a visit to an audiologist or other healthcare provider. Frank Lin, MD, PhD of Johns Hopkins, told CR expects that consumer electronic companies like Samsung and Apple may enter the market with these devices, which may at first look like some of the DTC options already available, but may be subject to additional rules. Once the OTC rules are finalized, the new competition could drive down prices and open innovation in hearing aid technology, which likely will be a plus for consumers. And let's close out the day with a little bit of laughter, the best medicine. There's two witches. There's a picture here of two witches stirring a cauldron, and one of them's reading a recipe book. Tarantula blood, scorpion tail, rat intestines, kale? Hanukkah explained. Every year I spell Hanukkah differently, and it's correct every time I do. Hobo Splendido. Imagine if your cell phone battery was listed 10% and it lasted for 8 days. Now you understand Hanukkah. Holy Ghost, New York City. Christmas movies rebooted as Hanukkah movies. Home Shalom, A Christmas Carol, King, It's a Wonderful Life When You Call Your Mother. There's an order of monks that is sworn to silence, but each year one monk is allowed to say two words. The day arrives and a monk stands up and says, Oatmeal Lumpy. The abbot then declares the session over. The following year, another monk stands and says, Oatmeal Fine. A year later, it's a third monk's turn. I quit, he says. The abbot's shocked. Why? The murdered monk replies, I can't stand the constant bickering. He died doing what he loved at my funeral, saying cars have to stop for pedestrians as he stepped bravely into the car crosswalk. It's sad when the only man who can tell me I know what you want is my barista. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin. Reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.